All right, we'll get started. Okay, so I have your midterms. They're going to sit here and tease you for a while, but I'll give them back during the break, and then after the break, we'll take them up, take it up. Okay, so last class we were talking about max. We had a problem with the projector, so I wrote on the board. I copy and pasted the notes over from last year, so they are in the notes, but there was maybe a few things that I said that were slightly different or little things I missed. So I thought just to refresh us and also to make sure that I cover everything that's written, we could just go through it really quickly. So the idea here is we're creating this tag value A, which is the MAC on a message of a key K. The best attack on the MAC. So first off, what is the attack? What are you trying to do? Well, what you're trying to do is you're trying to forge a value A for a message that's different than any message that you observe. So you might see the MAC on 10 different messages. You have some message that's not that one of those 10 messages. You want to create a MAC on your message, but you don't know the key. Okay, that should be impossible. Now, the one attack that always works is you can brute force the key. Okay, so you can do exhaustive search on the key, and ideally that should be the best attack. Okay, there shouldn't be an attack that's more efficient than just doing the exhaustive search on the key itself. Okay, and then the important thing is that there's no confidentiality. Okay, so if you can look at the output of a MAC A and you can determine what the message was, that's, we don't care. Okay, now it turns out that when we use HMAX, they're going through a hash function, which gives you pre-image resistance anyway. So in practice, you wouldn't be able to recover M from A. But if I came along with a new MAC value that had all the other security properties in terms of forgeability, but you could look at it and figure out what the message was, that's technically not a problem. Okay, this is what we use encryption for. Okay, so MACs and encryptions are solving totally different things. Okay, one's about keeping secret, confidentiality, and the other is making sure that modifications can't go undetected by the person that holds the key. Sensibly, we would want both, okay? So that's the next thing that we're going to talk about is how we combine the two of them. Okay, then we went through a couple of examples. So if you just hash without a key, then anyone can compute it. So this works fine for error-correcting codes where you don't care about an adversary human being trying to modify it, because if they modify it, they can change the hash. If your only concern is like errors that are introduced by the network, you could send your message and just a hash of your message. Then the chances of the errors changing both such that they both work out are very, it's small, it's negligible. But with a human that was purposely trying to change the message, they could also just change A as well, okay? Then we looked at two simple ways of adding in the key. So we can either add it at the start or at the end. If we add the key at the start, we're vulnerable to length extension. If we add it to the end, it's technically secure, but if you have collisions, then you're going to run into trouble where somebody can spend a bit of time trying to find a collision between two messages, even though they have no idea what the key is, and that's going to be a collision in terms of the MAC as well, okay? So we don't like that. Because that's technically it's an attack that's stronger than exhausting the search of the key. Okay, you can run it twice as fast because collisions are twice as easy to find. I should say twice in the exponent. It's square root complexity because of the birthday paradox. Okay, so what did we come up with? So we came up with this construction. So we have an inner hash, we have an outer hash. The inner hash is protected. This value itself, the adversary never sees because of the pre-image resistance of the outer hash. Therefore, you couldn't do a length extension on the inner hash. Otherwise, this looks exactly like the attempt 2 that was vulnerable to the length extension. Okay. Now, in real life, there's some padding. So you add a bit of padding on both the inner and the outer hashes, and that's meant to kind of spread out differences. But it doesn't really matter in terms of what you do. At the end of the day, you only need pre-image resistance from your hash function. So if you implemented HMAX and you use it with a hash function, and then eventually people were able to find collisions in it, that happens quite naturally because it's a lot easier to find collisions than pre-images, then you're still fine technically. Your MAC is still fine. When if people start finding pre-images, then you have a problem with your Mac. Yeah. So this is a good question. I didn't really explain well. Let me just sort of I'll add it onto the side. Actually, let me put it in the notes. Otherwise, I'll have to re-upload a copy of these notes. Okay, I'll come back to that. Okay, the one last bit is that how big does the Mac have to be, the Mac value itself? Well, if the Mac value is smaller, if it's a small value, then that's fine. The only attack is that you might get lucky. So you might just make up a Mac value and it might just happen to be the right Mac value for that message and that key. Okay, and so what you want to do is you want to bound the probability that an adversary just gets lucky by just choosing a particular value. Okay, and that's going to depend a lot on your application. Okay, another thing is you can sort of create your own luck because you can try a bunch of different values. So if you have some thing that's sitting there that will accept billions of values, then you can try billions of guesses, right? But like if it's a web page or something like that on the modern web, most web servers are going to cut you off, you know, after you do a whole bunch of failed attempts. So you could have this bigger or smaller depending on what other sort of protection you have on top of it. So typically we see things like 40-bit max or 64-bit max, and that's good enough. 1 over 2 to the 40 is still a very small probability that you would guess something correct. Okay. The other thing, too, is that max, you have to think about, like, they're providing some protection, but what's the lifetime of that protection? So if I'm having a conversation with you, let's say I send you like an email, normally you would sign an email, but let's say we're using Max for whatever reason. If I send you some message, you read it and then that's fine. You know, it wasn't modified. And if some adversary can come along 10 years later and break the Mac and then change the content of that email, well, you don't care because you've already read that email, right? You've probably forgotten that what it even said, okay? So the lifetime for that isn't that long. Encryption's different though, right? If I send you an encrypted message, you might want to keep that secure for 10 years, right? You might not want someone reading that in 10 years or 50 years or 80 years, okay? So that's another consideration we can think of in terms of Macs. Okay. So let's just circle back to the HMAC construction. I'll just go through the pre-image and collision resistance of it again. Okay, so the question is, first off, why can't we use length extension attacks to break this? Okay. Okay, so the first question is, well, what are you going to extend the length of? So a length extension attack extends the length of a hash function. We have two hash functions here, okay? So which is it that we want to extend? So let's just look at both, okay? So we have an inner and an outer. Okay, the inner you cannot extend because in order to extend a hash, you have to know its value. Okay, you can't extend it if you don't know what you're extending. Okay, why don't you know what you're extending? Because the outer has pre-image resistance. Okay, so inner, you can't. I'll be more specific. I'll say the adversary who observes AM. Okay, so you can't get this particular value out because of the pre-image resistance of the outer. Okay, what about the outer hash function? Could you do a length extension attack on the outer hash function? Okay, so you can. You can add stuff to it. Okay, so you can extend. But you're going to end up with the wrong format. So what you'll get is, just think of what's inside this hash function. It doesn't matter what it is. We could just call it x, but anyways, it happens to be this particular value. Okay, but it's just some message. Okay, and yeah, you could add some value onto the end. I'll call it z, since we use a for the tag itself. Okay, but this is not HMAC of M concatenated with Z. The HMAC of M concatenated with Z would have to see this Z put inside the inner hash. Okay, so we're extending it on the outer hash. We need it on the inner hash, and there's no way to do that. Okay, so yes, you can do a length extension, but it doesn't actually result in a valid MAC. So it doesn't do anything with you. Okay. Okay. Now, the second question, which was raised, is why can't collisions defeat HMAC? Okay, so what's a collision? So a collision means that, for example, you have M1 and M2. Such that the hash of M1 equals the hash of M2, and they're not the same. Obviously, if M1 equals M2, then that will always be true. Okay, so we have these two values. Now, the question is the HMAC of these two the same given that this is that M1 and M2 have the same hash? Does that mean the HMAC of M1 and M2 are the same? Okay. So we'll say given collision. Okay, and so we saw, I'll just phrase that as MAC. We saw that when the MAC is that attempt 3 or whatever we called it, this property does hold, or it could hold. We have to make some assumptions about the sizes of things, but it could very well be the case, okay? But in this case, what happens? So let's just expand it out and take a look. Okay, so a lot of these two values are the same, right? This is the same. It starts with the same value. This inner value is the same, okay? The only difference sort of comes up right here. Okay, so let's take a look at this inner hash function and just remind ourselves, what does it actually look like on the inside? So we have a compression function, and let's assume that the key and the message are one block each, okay? So we have some IV that comes in, and we take our first block, which we'll call the key, and then we have some output. Then we put it through the compression function again, and in this case, we have M1. Okay. And over here, we'll have the exact same diagram. The only difference is we'll have M2 instead. Okay, So the question is, well, let's start here. Is the number on this wire the same between these two diagrams? Yes. Okay, so these are the same. Are the values on this wire the same? No, not by definition, they're not. Okay. And so is the outputs going to be the same or different? They'll be different because this has the avalanche effect. As long as you change some of the input, it's going to be different. Okay. Now, remember, these are special. These aren't just any M1 and M2, right? These were found that had a collision, right? So does that collision property help us? Does it change our minds about the fact that these two values would be different? So we can look really quickly at what a collision means on the inside. So a collision means that M1 with the IV will give you some output, and M2 with the IV will give you some output, and these two outputs will be the same, even though these two differences are the same, okay? The problem is what's going into this isn't the IV. It's some other value, okay? So this collision holds when it's the IV, but as soon as this value changes from some other value, then it's no longer going to be a collision. It's specific to that specific value. Now the question is, well, could you sit there and crank out a collision based on these two numbers here? You can't do that because you don't know what the key is. The adversary doesn't know what the key is. Okay, so you would have to find a collision that for M1 and M2 where you had this value, but this value depends on the key and you don't know what the key is. Okay. So collisions don't help you break this particular construction of the hash function. Okay, questions on that or on HVACs in general? Yeah, so if you know the key, you don't even need collision resistance. You can just break it straight up. Yeah. So key sufficient. Okay, so let's talk about putting this together with encryption. Okay, so why do we want to combine the two? Well, there's a theoretical reason and there's a practical reason, and they turn out to be the same. So the theoretical reason is we kind of stalled out where we were trying to develop the CCA secure encryption, okay? And nothing that we were trying on the encryption front would unlock it. We had non-deterministic encryption like CBC mode and counter mode, and even that wasn't enough because we had these malleability problems, okay? When we put a MAC on the encryption, then any kind of attack based on malleability where you start flipping bits of the ciphertext, that's going to ruin the MAC. Okay, the MAC is going to serve to catch that, and so it's not going to allow you to do those attacks. Okay, so it's going to rule out all malleability attacks, and then as a result, we're able to get this CCA secure encryption. Okay, so that's a theoretical reason. Just from a practical standpoint, we said encryptions for confidentiality. Encryption by itself doesn't provide integrity. It doesn't prove to you that someone didn't change the message. So a lot of people have this notion of encryption where if an encrypted message goes along and someone starts tweaking bits, then when the person decrypts it on the other end, it's just going to decrypt to garbage, right? But encryption doesn't work that way. We saw it like with stream ciphers, if you flip bits, actually you decrypt to a very sensible looking plaintext. It's exactly the same except for the same bits are flipped, okay? So encryption will never give you integrity, okay? Macs give you integrity, but they don't give you confidentiality, okay? There's no way to protect the actual message itself, or it's not a goal of Macs, okay? So what we want is we want to put them together. So we have both encryption and we have Macs, and we tend to call this a secure tunnel. So that's like sort of the abstract view. So if Alice and Bob have a secure tunnel for sending messages back and forth, that tunnel is providing both integrity and confidentiality at the same time, okay? All right, so how do we do it? How do we combine the two? Well, there's a couple different ways of composing it, but the two simplest ones are basically you can Mac anything you want and you can encrypt any message that you want. So we just have to pick an order. Do we want to encrypt our message first and then put a Mac on the encrypted message? Or do we want to Mac the message and then encrypt the whole blob? Okay, so there's different pitfalls depending on which ones you do. Both of them ultimately are secure, but you have to be a little careful about what you're doing. So let's just do them in order. So we'll do encrypt, then Mac. And then we'll look at Mac, then encrypt. Okay. So we're going to encrypt first. So let's pencil that in. So we're going to encrypt under some key. And what we do is when we compose the two, we actually choose different keys. So the Mac key that we choose is different than our encryption key. Okay. So both of them are the same in the sense that they're both symmetric keys, meaning Alice and Bob both have the exact same key. It's a secret. They're the only two people that know it. The adversary doesn't know it. But we're not going to use the same key. If you use the same key, is it really a big deal? It depends. So it depends on exactly what encryption function and what Mac function you use. There's some combinations of Macs and encryption that you could get in trouble if you use the same key. There's other ones that you can prove are secure even if you use the same key. So anyways, just to avoid all the like hair splitting, let's just assume that they're different keys. Okay. So this is the encryption key, encryption decryption key. Okay, so we have our message, and then I'm going to make it explicit because it will turn out to be a little bit of a big deal. Because let's assume that we're using a block cipher, there could be some padding at the end of the message itself. Okay. Now, what we're going to say is that if you want CCA secure, then you have to get the best encryption that you can get. So we couldn't get CCA secure encryption, but we could get CPA secure encryption, okay? So we're going to require that this be some sort of CPA secure encryption. So it could be a stream cipher, it could be CBC mode, it could be counter mode, but if you use ECB mode, which isn't even CPA secure, then this whole construction is not going to be secure. Okay. So without loss of generality, let's just assume that this is CBC mode. Okay, that's the most common CPA secure mode. Okay, so in CPA mode, CBC mode, sorry, we have padding because it's a block cipher. What else do we have? What else is part of the ciphertext that gets sent in order to decrypt it? The IV, okay? So we have an initialization vector. So this is our ciphertext. We can think of it as this is the IV, and then this is the actual payload of the encryption of the message itself. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to take a Mac, and we're going to use a Mac key. All right, so we encrypt it, and then we're just going to Mac it, okay? Now, what's the problem with this construction? Okay, so why does it matter if the IV's there or not? So if it's not there, what does that mean? So to be clear, C and A are both sent from Alice to Bob. So say this is Alice and Bob. Okay, we're sending both these values. So Bob does know what the IV is. So it's not the case that he can't decrypt. It's just not included in the MAC itself. Why is that a problem? Okay, if it's not included in the MAC, what does that mean about that value? What can Eve do to that value? She can change it, okay? What if you change the IV in CBC mode? What happens? So that's true of the ciphertext blocks. What about the IV block? So there is malleability. So specifically what happens in an IV is if you flip a bit of it, when you decrypt, that same bit that you flipped will be flipped in the first block of your plain text block. Okay? So you can actually do very sensible attacks by flipping the IV. Okay? So it's really important that you include everything in the MAC, including the IV. Okay? And so there's lots of real-world examples of people that have implemented encrypt in MAC and forgotten to MAC the IV. Okay, that's like common, like crypto error 101, and you can do a lot of damage by doing that. Okay. Now the other thing you can do is you can MAC the padding as well. It's not strictly necessary, but it doesn't hurt. And there's a few problems that can arise where I don't want to go into detail on this because it's sort of a finesse, but you could look at it in terms of one of your projects. So there's been examples of this in SSL. What could happen is, first off, note that this can actually fail to decrypt. Okay. So what happens if you go and you flip a bit of C? So the adversary is sitting here on the wire. They flip a bit of C. Now the MAC is ruined on it, okay? So what's going to happen is the person's going to come along, they're going to try the MAC, and they're going to see that the MAC wasn't right, and then it's going to throw an error, essentially, okay? So that's one type of error that you can see. A second type of error is, let's say the MAC is right, but then when you come along and you decrypt it, let's say the padding's wrong. So the padding needs to have a certain format, okay? And what if it doesn't have the right format? Then what happens is you get what's called a padding error, okay? And your ability to distinguish, if you're an adversary where you can just try random values and the server is going to sit there and say, that was a MAC error, that was a padding error, that was a MAC error, that was a padding error, that's actually sufficient to fully decrypt the message. And so anyways, I could go through, like, it would take an hour to explain the whole attack. But it turns out to be quite substantial, okay? So what we want is we want to make sure that we lock the padding down as well. So if you put the padding in for the MAC as well, that's a good approach. Okay, the second thing you can do is MAC first and then encrypt. Okay, so we're going to start with a MAC of our message, okay? Then what we want to do is we want to encrypt it, okay? So this is going to be inside the encryption. And, of course, if we just, well, let's just pencil it in. Okay, what's the problem with this construction? So there's no malleability because the MAC will protect it. So it's true, you could tweak bits on the encryption function, but then the MAC is going to end up being wrong. Okay, can you decrypt this? So when you decrypt it, what do you get? You get the MAC of the message. Can you get the message from the MAC? No. Okay, so we need to send the message as well, right? So it doesn't matter. Typically, we put the MAC at the end. You could put it at the start. Okay. So remember, in MACs, we send M and A across the wire. So when we encrypt it, we're encrypting both M and A. Okay. We're encrypting the MAC and the message itself. Okay. Now when we decrypt, we get the message and we get the MAC, and then we can check the message against the MAC and make sure that's correct. Okay. Now, the next thing is, if this is a block cipher, then we're going to have padding here as well. Okay. And the final thing is that the output of this will be a ciphertext if this is CBC, but we also have an IV. Okay, so the IV is here as well. Okay, now what happens if we attack this, say this is CBC mode, and we do a malleability attack, and we change some of the padding bits at the end? What happens? So on one hand, yeah, sure, it is garbage. It's just padding. It doesn't mean anything. But will we get away with that attack? We're going to get away with it because the MAC doesn't cover the padding itself, right? Okay, and this is the exact example where having the ability to figure out if it's a padding error or if it's a MAC error can get you in big trouble. Okay, so what we like to do is we like to put the padding inside the MAC as well. Okay, it's actually very necessary. Okay, and the other thing we like to do is we like to put the IV in the MAC as well. Because the adversary could flip the IV. If they flip the IV, the message will change. Now, technically, the MAC is on the message. So if you change the message, even though you're doing a sensitive... Yeah, the message itself would be covered by the MAC. But just like we MAC'd everything up here, the IV and the padding, we like to MAC all three values. Okay, and then that locks all three values in. You can't change them. Okay, so SSL, for example, or TLS... They use this approach in most cipher suites. We'll talk a little bit later. So the newest version of TLS does it slightly different. And then SSH does this approach. So those are two protocols that do it. Okay, both of them are perfectly fine. Okay. Now the final thing we might ask ourselves is... here, if we, let's say we implement our MAC as an HMAC, we have to have an encryption function lying around. We have to have a hash function lying around in order to use the HMAC. And it's kind of complicated. It's like we're MACing something and then we're hashing or we're encrypting something. So we're sort of using two functions. Would there be any time savings if we combine the two? Could we, you know, come up with, say, a mode of operation that kind of did a MAC at the same time that it was encrypting? And then you could just do both at once. Maybe we could guarantee that you could use the same key, so you just have one key, and it might just be a little faster than just going all the way through the encryption function, then going all the way through the MAC function. Okay, we could cut some corners. So it turns out that you can. So this is called authenticated encryption. It's generally for block ciphers. The other thing when you MAC and encrypt is here you have to put the message all the way through the encryption function. Okay? So like imagine that this is an easier example to see it. Let's say the message is sort of trickling to you slowly, okay? So what you're going to do is you're going to encrypt the message byte by byte as you receive it, okay? But then in order to MAC it, you kind of need the whole ciphertext line around so you're ready to MAC it, okay? So it's harder to sort of encrypt this in a single pass. It's kind of like you have to put it all the way through the encryption function, then all the way through the MACing function. So you're sort of touching your message twice when you encrypt it. So what this allows you to do is it allows you to do a single pass of message. And you can just use one common key. So the most common example is called GCM. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah, so what they'll do is, so there's security guarantees. So as I mentioned here, it's not always the case that there's an attack if you use the same keys. It's just that some combinations of MACs and encryption are bad. So this is very generic. It's kind of plug and play. Choose your encryption mode of operation you want, as long as it's CPA, and then choose your MAC. So for example, let's say that you did CBC mode for your encryption. And then there's a MAC that's also based on CBC. We didn't cover it. It has its own security problems. But if you combine CBC encryption with CBC MAC, then it turns out if you use the same key, it's not going to give you the same security guarantees that you want. Exactly, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So this has a special guarantee that it's okay in this case. Okay. So it's hard to prove. Well, you just can't prove it in general that if you use any encryption in any MAC that it's always safe. But in this case, we're going to say, here's exactly the MAC you're using. Here's exactly the encryption you're going to use. And for this combination, we can prove that it's secure to use the same key. Okay. So there was a really nice paper early on that had a very simple construction of how to do this. But then there were some patent issues with it. So the authors took out a patent on it, and then it wasn't clear whether you could use it. And a lot of the internet works on like open source software and things like that. And so it became kind of encumbered. So then people were like, okay, can we come up with some other mode that's sort of similar based on the same principle, but doesn't violate the patent? So they came up with this mode. It's called Galois counter mode, or GCM. You see it in SSL or TLS. So you see it on the web all the time. So it's a very common one. It is a counter mode, just like we looked at counter modes already. But what happens is instead of just simply incrementing your counter when you encrypt every block, when you increment your counter, you take in part of the message and you process the message in terms of how you're incrementing your counter so that it's also fingerprinting the message for you at the same time. That's sort of the high-level picture. This is a very complicated construction. You can do a final project on it. I think it's one of the lists of topics. It's kind of like that level of a topic, not really something I want to cover in class. There was also a competition called the CSER contest. So this is so complicated that cryptographers don't really like it. And the Galois part refers to a special kind of math of number theory. And so it uses this like special mathematical constructions, and it seems like maybe it's not the most optimal way of doing it. So there was a competition to replace GCM. It's called CSER. And I haven't checked in with it, so I don't know if it's done or not. I can't remember. Maybe Google it real quick. Yeah, okay. So it's still ongoing. So they haven't announced it. Well, they have December of 2017 penciled in. So maybe we'll have an answer soon. So I was looking here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my bad.
No problem. Okay, so yeah, in a couple months we'll have a new GCM thing if everything goes on, but it looks like they haven't updated it in a while, so I don't know what the current status is. It's not a NIST competition, if I remember right. It's just sort of a side competition by some cryptographers. Okay. Okay, so let's just do a wrap of encryption, so summary. So we have three levels, OTS, CPA, CCA. Okay, and then we saw a bunch of different things. So we saw a bunch of modes of operation, ECB, CVC, counter. We saw stream cipher, which is the same as counter. Encrypt then MAC then encrypt. And then AE, authenticated encryption, or GCM as a specific example of it. Okay, so ECB is one-time secure. Not CPA, not CCA. CBC is CBA secure, okay, but it's not CCA. Counter mode is the same. Stream cipher is the same. Okay, and then these three, when done right, are CCA secure. Okay. I'm not going to prove that, say, encrypt then MAC or MAC then encrypt is CCA secure. What we did is we showed why they're not certain things, but we never showed a constructive positive proof just because they're a lot harder to do. But I'll give you some intuition for it. Okay, so we know why CBC or counter mode, for example, is not CCA secure. Okay, so let's just see why that doesn't work when we both encrypt then a MAC. Okay, so just as a reminder, why isn't it secure? Well, let's take CBC mode, for example. Okay, so what will you do in the game, in the CCA game? So what you'll do is you'll say, so here's the... Alice and the Oracle. So Alice will send M0, M1. She'll get back CB. M0 might be two blocks of all zeros, and M1 might be two blocks of all ones. Okay. Now she can ask for the decryption of anything. Okay. So she can't, except for CB. Okay. She can't ask for the decryption of CB. Okay. So what she'll do is she'll take CB and she'll create some variant of it, which equals. CB with, say, 1-bit flip. Okay, and then what you'll get back is something that looks either like 0001000. Sorry, it'll look like garbage in the first block for CBC mode, and then it'll have the bit flip in the second block. Or the opposite. Okay, she sees this, she guesses b equals 0. Here she guesses b equals 1. She'll win 100% of the time. Okay, so we add a Mac to this picture. What happens? So we just, let's attack it the same way. We'll assume that we're doing encrypt then Mac, or Mac then encrypt, doesn't matter. We'll assume that we're using CBC as the underlying encryption, okay? So we'll ask for, we'll start with M0, looks the same. We'll start with M1, it looks the same. We'll ask for it, we'll get CB, that's exactly the same. We'll take our CB that we get, we'll flip the bit, we'll send it here, okay? What will the Oracle's response be? Invalid, right? It's, as soon as we flip that bit, what happens? Well, the Mac is going to fail, right? Because you're going to decrypt it to some garbage, and you're going to run your garbage through your Mac, and the Mac's going to be like, that's not the right value. Okay. So as soon as you send CB, what would happen is, instead of getting MB prime back, what you would get back, so this is in the encrypt and Mac, you would get back Mac error. And you could sit there and you could flip a different bit or flip a different bit. You could sit there flipping bits all day and you just get error, 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 error. Okay? That's all you would ever get back. Okay? With overwhelming probability. Okay?
Wasn't it bad to specify if you have a Mac error and a pad error?
Yeah, so in this case, we can just think of it as an error. The Mac is more informative to you as students. Your software should never tell you what type of error. It should just say error. And there's a whole bunch of red tape around that. So there's an attack called Lucky 13, which is actually the sort of extension of a bunch of previous attacks that's based on that idea of distinguishing the two. Sometimes at the very end of class, if I have time, I run you through that attack because it's actually really cool how it works. And it's within your realm of understanding with like all these modes of operations and paddings and things like that. It's a little time consuming. To explain. So yeah, maybe at the end we'll come back to it. But otherwise, I think you could do your project on Lucky 13. I think it's a valid topic. Okay, is there any questions on this? Okay, any questions on anything from the start of the course until now? Because we're about to do a major gear shift. Yeah, so one-time CAD would be, so it depends on, it's going to get really picky in terms of how you rekey it. So one-time CAD would be CPA secure in a really strong sense, an even stronger sense, but it would not be CCA secure because you could still flip bits. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so what we've done so far is we've looked at the symmetric case, okay? So let's say so far. Okay, so Alice and Bob have the same value, and with that value, when you have this arrangement that Alice and Bob have the same value, they can have all the properties of a secure tunnel, both integrity and confidentiality, using some combination of encryption and Max or some blended mode. Okay, so that's good. Now the question is, how does Alice and Bob end up with the same key? Okay, this was the issue that we always punted on, right? Especially if Alice and Bob have never met, okay? How do they get the same key? They can't send it over the channel that they're using because the adversary's on that channel, okay? Or at least it seems like that's the case. That seems like a reasonable statement, okay? Now, it turns out that there actually is a little trick that you can play. where you can use an insecure channel, and you can both come to an agreement on a key value that you're going to use, even though the adversary is allowed to sit in the middle and see all the messages that go back and forth. Okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to sort of disguise values in really hard math problems. Okay? We're going to have these math problems that are intractable that you can't solve. And what we're going to do is we're going to use them to sort of hide information. Okay? And when we have that, what we're going to do is we're going to derive three kinds of algorithms. One's called a key agreement algorithm, where Alice and Bob can, over an insecure channel, agree on a symmetric key. We're going to have what we call a public key encryption algorithm, where instead of Alice and Bob having to have the same key, Alice has some key that she puts on her website that everyone can use. Okay, anyone can take that key, encrypt a message to that key, and Bob in this case, will have a secret key that decrypts it. Okay, and he's the only one that knows it. Okay. And then we're going to do something similar for Macs. Okay, we're going to have a public key version of a Mac. We'll call it a digital signature. And in this case, what Bob will do is he'll have the same setup. He'll have a public key. He can put it on his website. He can send a message. He can sign the message. And you can go grab his public key and check that that message was actually signed by the key that corresponds to the public key. Okay, and the key that he's using is a secret key that he only knows himself. Okay, so the idea that these encryption and signature schemes have two keys now, a private key that only you know and a public key that you give out to everyone else, we call it asymmetric encryption or public key encryption or cryptography, I should say, not encryption because it's encryption and signatures. Okay, now the big difference here is what it looks like, what these schemes look like on the inside. So when we looked at AES, we saw logical operations, lots and lots of stuff. You know, I had to show you a video to show you how it worked. It's not like something I could write down. Okay. What we're going to have instead in this setting is we're going to have very simple one-line equations, essentially, that are going to be your encryption scheme or your signature scheme. Okay. However, they're going to be premised on math instead of logic. So instead of them being XORs and ANDs and all that kind of stuff, they're going to be some math-based equation, okay? And we'll talk about that actual mathematical setting for a while, okay? So that's what just aesthetically, it's going to look completely different from this part of the course forward in terms of what these actually look like, okay? So for the next half of the course, it's all going to be sort of math-based cryptography. Now, this math-based stuff is way slower, okay? It's more powerful because it's a more general setting. You don't have to assume anymore that Alice and Bob have these secret keys, okay? But it's going to be a lot slower than the stuff that we've used. So even though you can do more with this new type of encryption, it doesn't mean we throw away the old stuff, okay? In fact, what we do is we use the new stuff, the more powerful stuff, just to get Alice and Bob to have a key that they both share and that nobody else knows. And once we have this setting, then we switch to the old style of encryption in Macs, block ciphers, and stream ciphers because they're so fast. Okay? So a true cryptographic protocol will start by doing some public key operations, which is just going to get two keys to both parties. And then once both parties have both of their keys, then we switch over and we do everything that we've seen so far. Okay? So this isn't going to replace all the old stuff that we talked about, okay? Now, the big problem with this, not a problem, but the thing with this is it does require a certain mathematical background that you probably don't have, okay? Maybe you have it if you took, if you're from CS as opposed to engineering, maybe you touched a bit on it. It would be buried in, like, some course, like a abstract algebra course or something like that. And even when it's taught in the math setting, it's not clear what you actually need in order to make this work. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a good solid lecture, a lecture and a half maybe, on just the math. Okay. So there's forget about cryptography, encryption, all that stuff. We're just going to talk about math. And then when we're done, everyone's looking really scared. You should be terrified. It's going to be abstract algebra. It's going to be really hard. It's not that hard. Okay, but anyway, we're going to take a while to study the math, and I'm going to make it really concrete. So we're going to look at a very specific instantiation, even though you could generalize it and do it in a lot more ways. If we lock down one instance, then you can actually see visually like kind of the different patterns and stuff in the numbers, and it's a lot easier to sort of understand. Okay, so I'm going to try and simplify this as much as possible. Okay, so I'll call it part two of the course. Okay, so we'll look at key agreement. So we'll look at two types. One of them uses just uses public key. It's called key transport. The other one's called Diffie-Hellman. Then we'll look at public key encryption. The most famous is probably RSA. It was the first instance of it. We're actually not going to talk much about RSA. It'll be sort of a footnote because for reasons I'll explain actually when we get around to it. And then we'll look at digital signatures. So there's an RSA-based signature, and there's something called DSA, or the digital signature algorithm. Okay. We're going to look at two mathematical settings, and these will make a little more sense when we actually get there. But when we talk about math, this is going to be abstract math, okay? And what we're going to talk about is operating on a group of something, a group of elements, okay? And the group of elements in this case are going to be integers, okay? So the only kind of number we're going to see are integers. We're not going to see negative numbers. We're not going to see decimals. We're only going to see integers. Okay, and what we're going to do to make our lives even simpler is we're not going to allow any integer. We're going to actually bound the number of integers. Okay, so we're going to start at 0, 1, 2, 3, and then we're going to stop at some point. Okay, and then those are the only integers that we use. So maybe we stop at 11, okay? So we use the integers from 0 to 10, not inclusive of 11, okay? And so we're going to have some stopping point, okay? Okay. Okay, and where are we going to stop? Well, we're going to stop in two locations. So one location we're going to stop in is a prime number. Okay, so we'll always pick the upper bound to be a prime number, and there's some special mathematical reasons for why we pick it. Okay, so this is called the integers mod p. Okay, or what we're going to do is we're going to stop at some number n, which is the multiplication of two prime numbers. And technically, we're going to stop one before. We're going to go from 0 to p minus 1 or to n minus 1. Okay, and we'll call this integers module n. Okay, module in this case refers to some function called a modulus. Which hopefully you're familiar with. If you're not, it's not. You definitely know what it is, whether you know the name. Okay, so the mod is a function. It takes two arguments. We can call them A and B. So if I write A mod B, what is that? Okay, so what you're going to do is you're going to take A and divide it by B. So it's going to be A divided by b, and you're going to keep the remainder. Okay, what's 12 mod 10. 2. Okay? Okay, so it's 2 times 10. Sorry. Well, it's some number times 10 plus 2 will give you 12. Okay? Now, what we write is we can write equals if we want because it is the case that 12 mod 10 equals 2. Okay. Now, we might want to write the inverse, like to say that 2 mod 10 equals 12. That's not true because we haven't modded down 12. But what we have is a special equals called congruent. So it just has three dots. And it just means that when you mod these both sides by the same number, 10, in this case, then they end up being equal, okay? Okay, so 2 is congruent to 12, is congruent to 22, is congruent to 32 mod 10. Okay, so these are all the same number. When you mod them by 10, they all end up being the exact same number. So the big property here is, why are these all congruent? Well, we added 10 to them, okay? Where 10 is the modulus here, okay? So there's, in general, we have this rule that if you add the modulus to a number, it doesn't change the number itself, okay? So A plus P mod P equals A, okay? And in fact, you can not just add p once, you can add any number of p's that you want. So you can add p x times. So a plus b plus b plus p x times will always result in a. Okay. So x can be any integer, and it can also be plus or minus. So give me a negative number that's congruent to mod 10, to 2 mod 10. Okay, minus 8. All right. So why minus 8? Why not minus 2?
2 minus 10.
Okay, so minus 8 plus 10 will give you 2. Okay. So what you can think is, if you want to think of a number line, you can say, okay, here's 0. Here's P. Here's P. Okay? And if we have a particular number, call it A. Okay? What's congruent to A? Well, whatever this distance is here, this distance from here will also be congruent. And then similarly, we can go to minus p. And it looks exactly the same distance from minus p. Okay. Okay, so let's say we have minus A mod P. Well, what we can do is we can always, I'm going to stop writing congruent just because I get lazy. So I'll just write equals, even though sometimes I mean congruent. We can always add P to it. It doesn't change the value. Okay, that's another way of thinking about this rule. Okay, so minus A mod P is going to be the same as P minus A mod P. Okay, it's just minus A plus P is p minus a. Okay, so if you ever have a negative number and you want to bring it back between 0 and p, you can just add a p to it, and then that will work. Okay, so we'll use this fact at certain times. Okay, so I see some confused looks. So think of an application of this that we're all familiar with. So let's think of a clock. And this clock's almost the same as the clock, except for we're going to call this top thing 0 instead of 12. Okay, otherwise it's a clock. Okay, so whatever, let's say it's 10 o'clock. And I say, meet me in 4 hours. When do I meet you? 2. Okay, why 2? Okay, so, well, you can look visually. So 10, and then we go up, and then we wrap back around, okay, to 2. Okay, so that's what a mod is. A mod is basically a wrap. Okay, so you go up to P. So let's say you're here, and you add some distance to it. Then you go past P, but then when you actually do the mod, you can just sort of slide it back down here. So what you can do is you can think of counting. So you go 0, 1, 2, 3. Eventually you get to P minus 1. And then at P, you wrap back to 0. Okay? So you just go around and you just wrap, just like a clock. Okay? So a clock is, it's addition mod 4, or multiplication or whatever you want. So it's the integers. Module 12, sorry. Okay, and so why does this work? Well, this is 10 plus 4 mod 12 equals 2. Okay, and then how does negative hours work? Let's say you want to do 10, or let's say it's 2, and you want to go minus, 4 hours ago. Well, ignore AM, PM. 2 hours at 2 o'clock, we want to talk about 4 hours ago. Okay, so then we have 2 minus 4 mod 12. Okay, so we get minus 2 mod 12. Okay, so we can add 12 to it. Okay, so if we want to talk about a sensible time, you can always add a copy of 12. So what's 12 minus 2? Okay, and of course you don't need to know that. Like, you know that 2 minus, 4 hours ago is 10, just because you're so used to doing modulo math here. But visually you can see it the same way. So 2, if you minus 4, then you go back to 10. Okay, so the integers that we talk about are just like a giant clock. Okay, except for instead of going to 12 and then wrapping, they're going to go to a big number and then wrap. Okay, otherwise they're going to behave exactly the same. Now, what we don't do with clocks a lot, even though we could, nothing breaks, is multiplication. Okay, so we could talk about like 2 o'clock times 4, okay, and all the arithmetic works, but we think in terms of addition. There's no like kind of real world application where we really go around talking about multiplication, okay? But multiplication also works on clocks, okay? Now, for encryption, we're going to do multiplication, okay? We're not going to be using addition at all. We're going to be using multiplication, but other than that, it's basically just like a big clock. Okay, questions about this? No? Okay, so let's go for our break then. All right, we'll get started. Okay, so the midterms are 16, 4 questions for each. The distribution, Mark distribution, looks as follows. And so I think the average was somewhere around 7, 8, somewhere in there as well. I'll put a copy of this up on the website so you can spend more time staring at it. Okay, so the first question, there's two parts to it. I'll spend more time in part A, and then I'll just quickly do part B because they end up being exactly the same. Okay, so the first one's about 5 bits. All right, so you have a hash function. The hash function, say it's SHA-256, so it's going to spit out 256 bits. You're only going to keep the first 5 bits, and you're going to throw away the rest. Okay, so this whole thing is 256. Okay, so the question's asking, how hard is it to find a collision from this hash output? Okay, so what's a collision? So a collision means that these 5 bits are the same. Okay, and since we're throwing away these bits, we actually don't care whether they're the same or not. Okay, and we don't care what these 5 bits are. We just care that they're the same as the other 5 bits that you found. Okay. So we can write down an equation. It's actually just straight from the notes, okay? And so what we're going to do is we're going to write down, for example, n to be the amount of work. So how hard is it in terms of number of hashes? So we'll let n be number of hashes. Okay. And what we're going to do is we're going to use the expected value equation. So let me write it in general first. So number of collisions equals attempts times the probability of success. Okay, so we want to find one collision, that's fine. The number of attempts is going to be some function of n, okay? Specifically, if we, let's say n's 100, how many chances do we have of defeating it? Well, each of the 100 could match with any of the other 100, okay? So it's going to be 100 choose 2, or in the general case, it'll be n choose 2, okay? And what's the probability that it's a match? Well, the probability that the first bit matches is going to be a half. Okay, either a zero, both are zeros, or both are ones. Okay, if one's a zero and one's a one, then it's not a match. Okay, we have to match 5 bits, so it's going to be a half times a half times a half, 5 times. Okay, so then it's just a question of solving the equation. So this is n times n minus 1 over 2. 2 to the 5. Now, different people did different things in terms of approximating this. You can do the exact equation if you want. Exact will give you n squared minus n equals 64. If you can solve the quadratic equation, you'll get 8.5. You can approximate it as, for example, you might, this is, ends up being n squared minus n. You could just ignore the n and keep the 2, or you could get rid of the 2 as well. But let's assume that that top thing is approximately n squared. Then we're going to get 2 times 2 to the 5. That's 1. So we get n squared over 2 to the 6. So n is going to be half of 6, so it's going to be 2 to the 3, which equals 8. Okay, questions? Okay, and then on the other half, on B, it's the exact same thing. In this case, it's the last 4 bits. The fact that it's the last bits or the first bits is inconsequential because the output is fully random. So it ends up being the exact same analysis. The only difference is that you have a 4 instead of a 5. So we'll just say it's the same. Except for we have 1 equals n choose 2 of 1 over 2 to the 4 instead of 5. Okay? And then that will give you n equals. So if you want the exact equation, it will give you n equals 1.7. So this is exact. And then with various approximations, you might get a number bigger or smaller, depending on how you approximate it. But it should be very close to 6. So it might be 5 or it might be 7 or something like that. Okay, questions? Okay. So the next question says, we have a phone. There's some randomness. It's 1,000 bits. It goes through an extractor. You get 128 bits. Then you get a PRG. And so you're going to get a set of keys. Then you're going to use the keys to encrypt something. Okay? And in both cases, there's something wrong with the randomness. Okay? So it's not a full 1,000 bits of randomness. It's going to be some other form of randomness. And so the question is, okay, what can you actually do given that this is the particular case? So let's start with the first one. So this is the 10-bit version. And then the 15 will be the same, just with a 15 instead of a 10. All right, so we have 10 bits here that are actually a secret. Okay, so we have no idea what these 10 bits are. And then we have the total thing is 1,000 bits. And in this case, we know what these particular values are. Okay. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to take this value. We're going to put it through an extractor. And we're going to get out a particular value. This value will be 128 bits. Then we'll put it through the PRG. And then we'll get out, whatever, a bunch of keys. Okay, we'll take, say, the first key. We'll put it into the encryption function. Okay, and then the final output is C. Okay, you can think of C as 128 bits long as well. Although the message doesn't specify, so let's actually just leave that. Okay, so what happens in this case? Okay, so what we have here is we have 10 bits that we don't know. So the question is, how many values do we have up here? How many possible values, 1,000-bit values, do we have? Okay, so we know all of these bits, okay? So there's only one value for all of these bits. We don't know what these bits are, so how many values are represented by 10 bits? If we don't know 10 bits, how many possible values are there? Okay, so there's 2 to the 10, positive 10 values. Okay, so we have 2 to the 10 possible values. We run them through the extractor. How many possible outputs of the extractor could we see? Okay, let's say there were 2 values that we put through the extractor. How many values could come out of the extractor?
Y1.
So if there's 2 values, call them A and B. You put A through the extractor, you get 1 value. You put B through the extractor, you probably get a different value. Okay, so you're going to get 2. Okay, so the extractor is not going to add values. It can't add randomness. Okay, it's a deterministic function. So if you put 100 values through an extractor, you'll get 100 values as your output. If you put 2 to the 10 through, you'll get 2 to the 10 output. So there's only going to be 2 to the 10 possible values here. Okay. Then we put it through a PRG. Does a PRG introduce any randomness? Okay, so if we put 2 to the 10 values through the PRG, how many values do we get out? 2 to the 10 as well. Okay. Now we're going to encrypt with a key. How many possible keys are there? There's 2 to the 10 possible keys, right? Okay. So we start with 2 to the 10 randomness. We put it through a function. We get 2 to the 10 outputs. We put it through another function. We get 2 to the 10 outputs. So, and then we use that output as the key. So there's 2 to the 10 possible keys. Okay. So if we want to decrypt this ciphertext and we don't know the key, how do we do it? So what attack always works? Brute force. So we exhaustively search. Okay. So we can decrypt C. How many keys are we going to have to try? Okay, 2 to the 10 keys. Okay, so how much work is this? So it's 2 to the 10 work. Okay, what exactly is the work? What do we have to do every time we have a candidate? So I'm going to try my first key value. Well, I have to put it through the extractor, then through the PRG, then through a decryption function with the key. Okay, so it's going to be 2 to the 10 work, where work is basically an encryption plus a PRG plus an extraction. Okay, so we do all three of those values 2 to the 10 times, and then eventually I'll find the right key. You can say 2 to the 9 on expectation, because that's worst case is that you have to try all the values. That's also acceptable. Yeah. Correct. So what an extractor will do is it will only guarantee, so it's a little different. It's not that you're getting the randomness. It's if you want to shorten it to a particular length, it tells you what length you have to shorten it so that it's uniformly random. Yeah. No. So the amount of how many bits of entropy are here? There's 10 bits of entropy. So what that means is if you wanted a 5-bit output of your extractor, you could get it. You could get 5 bits that are uniformly random. Okay? It's 5 bits uniformly random. But what's happening here is that they're taking 128 bits. Right? Even though that's like way more than they should. Right? Because they don't know that it's broken. Yeah. So you'll have your 10 bits and they'll be... Your 10 bits of entropy will still be in there. They just won't. It's not going to be uniformly random. It's still going to be spread out. Yeah. Okay. All right. So this question was like, I don't know. I was a little disappointed, I guess, that not more people got it, because I thought it was sort of simple, but I just wanted to make sure that you understood. Like, this is a mental model question, as we call it, where you just have to understand what's actually going on in the question. It's not the kind of question where you see the word PRG or extractor and it sort of triggers your memory. Oh yeah, like these things have these properties, and then you go looking at your notes. Okay. So a lot of questions I'll remind you for the final are going to be like this. Okay. Half of the battle is just understanding the question. And once you understand the question, then it should be a very straightforward answer. Okay. They're usually not tricky questions in that traditional sense. They're just that I'm trying to test that you understand the material, not that you can repeat back different properties of different primitives, or find something in the notes that looks related and then copy it down. You have a cheat sheet, so I'm expecting anything that's in the notes you could make an exact copy of. So that's never going to be the right answer to any of the questions. Okay. Anyways, okay. Then there's a variant where it's 15 bits. It's the last 15 bits. It's basically the same analysis. So we know this. We don't know this. There's 15. And so you're going to do 2 to the 15 work for the same reason. Okay? And this is very realistic, this scenario. Like, this is straight out of crypto stuff that goes wrong in the real world. Okay? This is exactly the kind of thing you would see in the real world. Okay? This process of extracting, running through PRG, creating keys, that's how your computer does cryptography. And there's been many, many cases of random number generators being broken and only not spitting out the full number of values that they could, only spitting out a few number of values, okay? So if you get a job and you're doing encryption, you have to be able to trace through a particular problem like this. It's a very, very practical question to be asked. This is not a practical question. Okay, it's not. This is a theoretical question. Probably wouldn't come up in a workplace environment, but it's good to know as well. So in this case, what we have is CBC mode, and we have four values that are being spit out by the IV. Okay, so the IV is only one of four values. You're going to try and show that this is not CPA secure, and then you're going to show that by how you win the game, and then you're going to tell me how often can you win it. Can you win it 100% of the time, or what's the case? Show that it's not just random chance that you're winning it. Okay, so you can assume that I know the game. I assume that you have that all in your cheat sheets anyway. So I'm just going to skip the steps of the game. I'll just show you how to win it. Okay, so there's different ways, there's different approaches to doing this, but I'll give you one. So what will happen is you'll have Alice and you'll have the Oracle. And you'll start off just the way that we normally start off. You'll send two challenge messages, M0, M1. We'll assume they're not the same. The Oracle is going to flip a coin. Okay, it's going to send back CB. Okay. Now, along with CB, because this is CBC mode, either inside CB or beside it, it doesn't matter how you conceptualize it, there is an IV. Okay, CBC mode has an IV, and that's the key to the problem. Okay, so it's going to send you some IV. Okay, we can, give it a little hat to distinguish that this is the challenge IV. Okay, so this is the particular IV value that you get. Who chooses the IV? Okay, so the Oracle chooses the IV. We could actually put it in the step. Okay, what's it choosing it from? So what we'd like is it to choose a random 128-bit value, but it's a broken. So it's actually just choosing randomly from four possible IVs. We can call them IV 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, so this is either IV 1, 2, 3, or 4. We don't know which one it is, okay? Then what we're going to do is we're allowed to ask for the encryption of anything we want, okay? Now, normally we wouldn't waste our time asking for an encryption of M0 because we just keep getting back values that have a different IV and it wouldn't help us, okay? But in this case, there's only four possible IVs, so there's actually a good chance that we do get something back with the same IV, okay? So what we could do is we can ask for M0. And now what we'll get back is we'll get back C0 with some IV. You can call it IV star, C0 star. Okay. Now, what IV are we going to get? Well, think of it as rolling a dice. It's basically going to roll the dice, and it's going to give us one of these four IVs. Okay. We don't know. We're not guaranteed any IV. Okay. Now, one of these IVs is the same. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to repeat this until IV star is the same as the IV that we got originally. Okay? Now, once these two IVs are the same, what can we say? Okay, okay. So if this matches, if the IVs are the same and the Cs are the same, then what message did it encrypt? Zero. If the IVs are the same but the ciphertexts are different, what did it encrypt? M1, okay. So if IV star equals IV and C0 star equals CB, then we guess B equals 0. Otherwise, if IV star equals IV and the ciphertexts are not equal, then B equals 1. And of course, if the IVs are not equal, then we repeat. Okay. All right, so that's the approach, okay? So this strategy will win this game with some non-negligible advantage. What's the particular advantage? Well, once we're in this line, okay, we'll win 100% of the time, okay? But how many times do we end up here as opposed to here, okay? We don't know. technically we could never win this game because we would just keep going forever. Let's say it happened to use IV1 and we kept asking for the message and it kept giving us IV2, 4, 3, 2, 4, like some, it was choosing randomly, but it just by chance happened to never give us IV1. Technically, we could play this forever, okay? But on expectation, we would expect to hit the right value, you know, four times. There's four values. So think of it as a four-sided die. Eventually, you're going to roll the same side of the die, and then you're going to win, okay? So some language about that was sufficient that, you know, it took on expectation four times or something like that. This was fine to get the mark. I wasn't picky about an exact explanation. So sorry, 3/4 of the time you'll repeat, and then 1/4 of the time you'll be able to distinguish. Okay, so the last question is, we have CBC mode. So we're going to encrypt our message. And we're going to encrypt it under some key. K, we can put the K in. Okay, and so we want to put an IV into this encryption function. We know that, you know, being able to have an unpredictable IV is very important, otherwise you can break the CPA game, okay? We don't have unpredictable IVs, so we have to do something in order to get an unpredictable IV, okay? So if IV is secure, then this whole construction is secure, okay? So what we're going to do to generate this IV value is we're going to start with K, and we're going to put it through a PRG. And that will give us an IV. Okay? And so the question is this secure or not? Okay? So it turns out it is secure. Okay, why is it secure? Well, we know this is truly random. And therefore, this will be random, computationally random as well. That's the guarantee. So if you have an unpredictable seed, you get an unpredictable output, and that's what we want. Now, the one thing that's kind of scary about this construction is when you send your ciphertext, you're going to send IV in plain text, right? You'll send IV along. And so isn't that going to leak your key, right? Okay, so PRGs are one way. Revealing IV does not reveal the key. Okay, now the final thing is, from an efficiency standpoint, does this make sense? Okay, could we do better in terms of efficiency? Okay, now the thing to observe is when you put K through a PRG, so let's just consider that little piece of the function. What is that? What other primitive do we know that puts PRG? That puts your key through a PRG. Stream cipher, okay? So if we put K through PRG, okay, we get the same essentially as a stream cipher. Now, what does a stream cipher look like? Well, a stream cipher, you would just do an XOR with your message, and then you're done, okay? That's a lot simpler than this, okay? You don't have to go through an encryption function. An XOR is a lot simpler than a whole full-fledged AES, okay? So yes, this is secure. It does fix your particular problem. You would never do it in practice because once you have your key going through a PRG, then you would just switch and use a stream cipher and XOR in your message with it. So that's the answer, yeah. So no, it doesn't make sense. You would use a stream cipher. It's basically a stream cipher with a bunch of extra stuff on the end. Now, this was really hard, okay? It was only worth one mark. But yeah, anyways, this is like this is a question that requires you to really like think creatively kind of about high things. It's not a type of question that the answer is sitting in the notes, okay? But yeah, yeah. Okay, so like I said, the average was around a pass, so it wasn't that great, but not that bad either. It's typical. This midterm I made, I think it's worth 15% of your final mark. So it's not worth a lot, and that's on purpose, because a lot of people struggle. You know, I've taught this course every year since I've been here, and a lot of people struggle with the midterm. You're maybe not used to the kind style of questions and that type of thing, so I make it not worth a lot. So don't stress out if you're sort of in the lower part of it. It's really important your rank as well. That's a lot more important than the actual mark itself. But yeah, so hopefully no one's too stressed about it, and yeah, you have lots of ability to catch up on your marks if you're worried about your particular mark. That said, there were students who did really, really well that got like perfect or one short of perfect. So it's yeah. Anyways, okay. Questions about this? Okay, so if you have specific questions about your actual test paper, you can ask me after class, or you can come to office hours. I'll stick around for a while, not forever. And you can keep your midterm paper, and I'll put the solution up on the website as well. Okay. All right. So no midterm questions. All right. So we'll go back to the lecture. All right. So the last thing I'll do is, or the next thing the next thing we'll do is I'll give you another example of modular math. So this is going to be mod 23, okay? I like 23. We'll use that as sort of the running example because it's small enough that you can actually write down all the numbers. It's a prime number. Beyond being a prime number, it's actually a special kind of prime number we'll call, which is called a safe prime. We'll get to that eventually. So this is like one of the smaller numbers that you can actually, you know, do the kind of crypto You can actually do the crypto on it. It won't be secure when you use a number that's this small. But if you want to test out all the algorithms and things like that, you can totally do it on something this small. Okay. So what does this look like in terms of math? So let's think of a number line again. Number line can go actually in either direction. And so in the middle, I'll put, let me put it down here. Yeah. Okay, let's think of the real number line first, okay, and then we'll think about the equivalent in terms of mod 23. All right, so we go 0, 1, 2, 3, blah, blah, blah. Okay, then we'll go up to like 21, 22, 23, 24. This will be the real number line, 25. 45, 46, 47, blah, blah. And then we can go into negative numbers as well. Okay, so in modular math, all of these numbers, what we're going to do is we're basically going to deal with the numbers from 0 to 23 minus 1, which is 22, okay? Why minus 1? Because there's 23 of them, okay? So including 0, there's 23 of them, okay? And so what that means is that whenever we get a number that's not between 0 and 22, we're going to map it into a number that is between 0 and 22. We're going to map it by using the modular function, okay? So you can think of the modular function as a mapping between the set of all integers into this smaller set of just integers from 0 to 23, okay? And the way the mapping works is very, like, intuitive. So all the numbers between 0 and 22 will be themselves, okay? So we'll have 0, 1, 2, 3, we'll have 21, we'll have 22. Then when we hit 23, what's 23 mod 23?
Zero,
right? Because 23 divided by 23 is 1. There's no remainder. The remainder is 0. Therefore, it's 0. Okay? So we'll go from 0 to 22, and then we'll wrap. We'll go back to 0, 1, 2, and then we'll go up to 22 would be 44. So 25 would be 0, right? No. Sorry, 46 would be 0. So that's 23... So this would be 22. Okay, 1, 2, et cetera, et cetera. And then here, if we go to minus 1, what's the number right before 0? 22. Okay, so minus 1 will be 22, minus 2 will be 21, and then we can count all the way down to minus 23, which would be 0. Okay, so if you want to think more visually too, you can... think of the numbers. So this is sort of what the mapping looks like, kind of maps back. Okay, so there's this mapping into this special set of integers, which is this integer set. Okay. Now we have a special term for this set of integers. We call it the symbol for the set of integers is Z. Okay, and if we want to say the integers from 0 to some number, minus 1, we just put the number down here. Okay, so this is Z23. Okay, now I want to talk about groups, okay? Groups are sets of integers, okay? So Z23 could be a group, we'll see. But there's extra rules in order to be a group, okay? So we'll talk about what those rules are. So we'll use G for group. We'll use Q for the upper size. Okay. And the difference between a group and Z is always from 0 to 22 in this case. Okay. A group, let's say we have G23. Well, G23 could be any group of 23 integers, not necessarily from 0 to 22. Okay. So it might be 0 and 21 and 25 and 46. As long as they add up to 23, then that's a group, okay? So a group isn't always a set of consecutive integers. It could be a bigger set of integers, okay? Okay. And in a group, I said integers because that's the example we're rolling with, but they don't even have to be integers. Okay. So a group is a more abstract object where you have a set of whatever, 23 somethings. Okay. Maybe they're integers. Maybe they're real numbers. Maybe they're points or coordinates. So there's an X coordinate and a Y coordinate. There's some points on a curve. Maybe they're lattices, whatever the case may be. Okay. Vectors, that kind of thing. Okay. Now we're only going to see integers in this class. Okay. So a group consists of basically three things. So the first thing we call the elements of the group. Okay, so the elements in this class will only look at integers. I'll briefly mention the existence of points on some curves, but we won't actually look at the math beside it. In general, they might be real numbers, they could be vectors, they could be points or coordinates. Okay, so they can be sets of anything you want. Okay, now the second thing is if you just have a bag of numbers, that's not that useful. What you want to do is you want to do some operations on them, like addition or multiplication or something like that. Okay. So the second thing we have is a set of operations that are permissible to do. Okay, and technically to be a group, there are different group-like structures, like there's groups and finite fields and Albion groups, and there's a whole bunch of different characteristics depending on exactly what set of properties they have. We're not going to split hairs in this course, but a group technically, you just need one operation. Okay, and so what we'll do is we'll always talk about multiplication. Module P or N or whatever the case may be, okay? Module just means that you do multiplication just like normal, and then when you're done, you mod it down, okay? So if when you multiply two numbers, you end up outside of the group, okay? You end up with some number that's bigger, then you do the mod, and that will map you back down into the group, okay? Let me draw this a little better. Okay, so if you multiply, I don't know, 3 times 21, you'll get some number that's over here, right? 63, and then you'll map it back down to whatever that is, mod p, okay? That's how multiplication will work, okay? In other types of groups that you might see addition instead of multiplication. You might see, like, XORs. You could see point operations, which are, like, doubling points on curves, that kind of thing. You could see vector operations, like say vector addition. These might be matrices, so you might have matrix multiplication, whatever. Okay, and the third thing is you're going to have some rules. So multiplication will kind of work, but the question is it's got to work in a certain way in order for it to be useful, okay? And some of these operations, you might make up your own definition of multiplication that's different than the multiplication that we know, okay? So why are we doing multiplication module P? Well, it's because it has some properties. Basically, it's going to behave the same way multiplication behaves when you deal with all the integers or real numbers, all the same properties that we're used to, okay? It's going to behave essentially the same, okay? It's not always the case that all operations will behave the same, okay? Okay, so there's four basic rules, or sorry, five. The first is that if A and B are in the group, then A times B mod P. So I'll use this as multiplication module P. A times B will also be in the group. Okay? So you'll never be able to leave the group because, and you can see why that's clearly the case, like the example I gave. If you multiply two numbers and you leave the group, well, when you mod down, you're going to come back into the group. Okay? So if the group is the set of integers from 0 to 22, you're never going to leave it, even though you're doing multiplication. The second is that if you take A times B and then multiply it by C, that's no different than taking A and times it by B or C, okay? So order of operations doesn't apply in terms of multiplication itself. Okay, the next one looks a little weird. There exists some element E such that A times E equals A. Okay? And so what this is the identity, what we call the identity element. So what's the element E that we're all used to that behaves this way?
One.
Okay. And so in this case, it will be one as well. One will be the actual integer that behaves this way. Okay. So if you have some numbers, I don't know, 5, and you multiply it by 1 mod 23, it's 5. Okay, it doesn't change, just like you're used to. Okay, this is a rule that's a little tricky that not every group has. You have to be a little careful about it. It says that for all the A's that are in your group, there's some other number in the group that when you multiply them together, you get 1. Okay? So what we call this number, we call it the inverse of A, okay? Which we can denote as A to the minus 1, okay? So in, let's say we're talking about real numbers, okay? If we're talking about real numbers, what is B in this case?
1.
So it would be 1 over A, okay? So you have A, and then if you multiply by 1 over A, then you'll always get back 1 as a result, okay? Now, in the groups that we'll be using, we won't have division, okay? We'll have multiplication, but no division, okay? However, because we have inverses, we can effectively divide, okay? So if we want to say A divided by B, instead of saying A divided by B, what we'll do is we'll take B, we'll invert it, so we'll find its inverse, and then we'll multiply A by the inverse of B, okay? And that will work the same way, okay? So, for example, it's very obvious that if you take 3 and divide it by 2, right, that's not going to give you something that's in your group, okay? So, you know, division's going to lead to real numbers or decimals, and we don't want that, okay? We want to stay in the integers. So we have to change the way division works. So what we're going to say is that 2 has some inverse. So some other number times 2 will give you 1, mod P, okay, and it's guaranteed to exist, and so we'll take 3 and we'll multiply it by 2, and then it will effectively invert it, okay, and then we can write down things, we can be lazy and write down division, even though technically we're not doing division, and division will work the same way that we think it will work. In particular, if we have some element, we'll call it A, if we divide by X, and then we multiply by X, those operations will cancel out, and we'll be left with A as a result, okay. So we're going to see that in encryption where you're multiplying in values and then dividing them off later to get rid of them. The final thing is it's commutative, meaning that A times B is the same as B times A. Okay, this is another thing that's not always the case. So for example, for addition and multiplication, we're used to it. Exponentiation, this isn't the case, right? 5 raised to the power of 7 is not the same as 7 raised to the power of 5, okay? So not every operation that we can think of has this particular property, but multiplication mod P has this property. Okay, so here's what we want. So we want some group where all properties hold. So 1 to 5 hold, okay? And for reasons that we'll come to explain in a bit, we want the size of our group to be a prime number, okay? And we're going to sweat a little bit trying to make this happen, okay? So it turns out that if we go to this, this is a group, okay? So Z23 is a group, it has 23 elements in it, okay? And all of those properties, the 5 properties hold for this particular group, with the exception of one. There's one property that does not hold for this particular group. Okay, what's the property that doesn't hold? Well, the inverse property does not hold for the value 0. Okay, because there's nothing, there's no inverse of 0. Or should I say the identity? No, the inverse, yeah. Okay, so 1 over 0 is, you know, or 0 to the minus 1, which is 1 over 0, is infinite, okay? Now, what we could do instead is we could say, okay, let's get rid of 0, okay? Let's go from 1 to 22, and that's a thing, okay? What we do is we denote it Z star 23. The star is going to denote the fact that we dropped 0. It has a stronger technical meaning than just dropping 0, but effectively in these groups, that's the end result, is that you get rid of 0, okay? And that's fine. So now we have the integers from 1 to 22, the integers from 1 to 22 do conform to all those rules, okay? Rules 1 to 5 hold. How many integers are there from 1 to 22? There's 22 of them, okay? Is 22 a prime number?
No.
No. So we started with a prime number. We had 23, but when we got rid of 0, then we ended up with something that wasn't prime, okay? So what we want is we want something that's prime and all those properties hold, okay? So what we're going to do is, instead of using all the integers, first off, we're going to start with Z23. We're going to drop 0. So now we're going to have 1 to 22. Then we're going to drop a bunch of more elements from it, okay? In fact, what we're going to do is we're going to drop half of the remaining elements. So we have 22 elements. We're going to drop half of them. So we're going to drop 11, and we're going to leave 11 in our group, okay? 11 is a prime number, okay? And so so what we have is, we have the integers from 1 to 22, Z star 23, and we have a subset of those integers, okay, 11 of them, that will form a group that's prime ordered, and we'll call that G11, okay? So we're going to go through all the math behind this, but that's sort of a roadmap of where we're going. So if we drop 0 from ZP, we get Z star P. Okay, so this is going to be the numbers from 1 to P minus 1. So this is a group. However, it's not prime. So the term we use is ordered. So we talk about the order of a group. That just means the number of elements in it. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at some subset of ZSRP, but it's going to take a while to get there. We're just going to play around with ZSRP for a while, and then I'll start to show you some of the properties. All right, so there's a bunch of mathematical facts. If this was a math course, we'd prove all of them. Instead, I'm just going to assert them. You can believe them or look up the proofs if you want. Okay. So the first fact is that for all the elements of ZSRP, so for all A in ZSRP, A is invertible. Or you can say there exists some B such that A times B equals 1. Okay. So that's just a fact. Okay. Now, this is only true when P is a prime number. Okay. If P is not a prime number, it's not necessarily the case that they're all invertible. Okay. So groups that are have a prime order have special properties. We stick to them. This isn't a math course, so I won't go through why that's the case, but anyways. This isn't really that complicated, but the order of ZSRP is going to be the integers from 1 to p minus 1. How many of them are there? There's p minus 1. Okay, with the exception of p equals 3, every prime number minus 1 is not prime, okay? Primes are always odd numbers. Prime minus 1 is always going to be an even number. Even numbers are never prime except for 2 is the only even prime number, okay? So p minus 1 will never be prime, okay? Therefore, the order of ZSRP will never be prime order, with the exception of p equals 3. Now, consequence of p minus 1 being even is that p minus 1 is always divisible by 2. Okay, so if you take p minus 1 and you divide it by 2, you will get a whole integer as a result. Okay, we'll use that fact. And what we're going to do, just as a sort of roadmap, is what we're going to do is we're going to be really interested in prime numbers where prime minus p minus 1 divided by 2 is not only an integer, but it itself is prime. Okay? So if you have a prime number, not every prime number is like it, but some prime numbers have this property that the prime minus 1 divided by 2 is also a prime number. Okay? This is called a safe prime, and we like it for reasons that you're going to see eventually. Okay, 23 is a safe prime. It does happen to have that particular property. Yeah, so order is the number of elements in it, in the group. I actually defined it, I think, up here. So it just means there's 23 of them or 22 of them. Okay, let's look at what a multiplication table looks like. For the integers mod 23. try and get this all into one screen. Okay, so what this is a multiplication table, just like the multiplication tables you probably saw, you know, in grade school, except for this is a special one, it's mod 3. Sorry, mod 23. Okay, so for example, what's 2 times 2? 2 times 2 is 4. 4 mod 23 is 4, because it's already less than 23. Okay, so you'll see that for any numbers that you multiply by each other, the result is always between 1 and 22. Okay, you never get outside of that, because if it was bigger than 22, when you mod by 22, it would map it down into 22. Okay. The second thing you might observe is that for every single number, let's look at the rows. So 1 times something will give you 1, okay? So 1 times 1 will give you 1. 2 times 12 will give you 1. So what does that mean about 2 and 12? They're inverses, okay? So that's a definition of an inverse, okay? So 2 times 12 will give you 1. So the inverse of 2 is 12, and the inverse of 12 is 2, or 2 divided by 12, even though we don't define division, is 1, okay? Or 2 divided by, 2 divided by 12 is 1, okay? Now, we said that an inverse should exist for every single element. So what does that look like visually in this multiplication table? That means for every row, there should be a 1 somewhere, okay? That's what it means, okay? So you can find a 1 here. Now, the other thing is if 2 times 12 is 1, what's 12 times 2? It should be 1 as well because of the associative rule, or the commutative rule, sorry. So 2 times 12 also gives you 1 here as well. Okay, so everything should be symmetrical in that sense. Okay, pointing doesn't help, but what's the number, the row?
12 on your right hand side.
12? Oh, number 11, yeah, thanks. Okay, anyways, okay, so these are all the inverses. So inverses do exist. Okay, and then otherwise you can just sort of read the numbers out. Okay, so if you want to know what's 8 times 9 mod 23, it happens to be 12. Okay, so there's not a lot of patterns to see here, okay? But where it becomes really interesting is when we consider exponentiation, okay? Now, can we do exponentiation? So we said that the only operation we want to do is multiplication, okay? But what is exponentiation? Exponentiation is just multiplication by itself a certain number of times, right? So 5 raised to the power of 2 is just, you know, 5 times 5 times 5, sorry, well, 5 times 5. So 5 to the power of 3, for example, it's going to be 5 times 5 times 5, okay? And so it would take a long time, but you could actually do exponentiation with a table like this. So you could say, what's 5 times 5? 5 times 5 is 2, and then 2 times 5 again would be 10, okay? So 5 times 3 would be 10. Okay. The other way you can do is you can actually just work it out just using normal arithmetic. So you could say, well, what's 5 to the power of 3 just in normal math? So 5 times 5 is 25, times 5 is 125, and then you can mod by 23. So what's 125 divided by 3? Well, it's going to be something or other with remainder 10. Okay. And that will give you the correct answer. Okay. Now, what will happen with exponentiation is you could use a calculator to do this, but these numbers are going to get really big really fast, okay? We're going to end up using really big numbers. You know, it's going to be like you know, 2 to the power of like some 256 or something like that, okay? Some really, really big number. Actually, way bigger than that, like a 256-bit number. So what ends up happening is you can't do it. But one of the rules about mod is if you're trying to do some equation, mod 23, you can take the mod at any time and it won't ruin your result, okay? So if you wanted to calculate 5 to the power 3 mod 23, you could do what's 5 to the power of 2? What's 5 times 5? Well, it's 25. You could take 25 and mod it down, okay? Then once you have 25 modded down, then you can multiply in the next 5, and then you can mod it down, and then multiply in the next 5 and mod it down, okay? So you don't have to wait till the very end to apply your mod. You can apply the mod at any point in your equation. So once your numbers are getting too big, you apply the mod. Now it's a small number, and you keep going in your operation, okay? So it doesn't matter when you apply the mod. You can apply it all the time, none of the time, at the end of the time, whatever. You're never going to actually ruin your result, okay? So that's how modular exponentiation works as a particular algorithm. It applies the mod sort of as you go. Okay, so your calculators aren't going to be able to do the kinds of things that we're able to do because your calculator is going to try and compute the big exponentiation and then mod it down at the end. Okay, you need like a special operation to do it. So we'll talk more about that in another class. Okay, is there any questions about this so far? Okay, good. So we'll talk about exponentiation next class.